Welcome to Gluck Radio. I am Dr. Errol Gluck, executive life coach and master problem solver. For this week's guest, Kristen Newman, wanderlust wasn't the only thing she was lusting after. This sitcom writer slash globetrotter joins us to talk to us about her travels all over the world and all the men she fell in love with on these journeys. Perpetually single and always on the go, Newman mastered the art of a relationship on vacation, a vacationship. She writes about her international affairs in her sexy and hysterical memoir, What I Was Doing While You Were Breeding. Newman reflects on the balance between emotional connection with men and her freedom as a young woman amidst Israeli bartenders, sexy Argentinians, and Finnish poker players. We'll find out whether Kristen was running away from something or living the life all are envious of.
So many women in their 20s and 30s feel the pressure to marry and start families, yet Newman chose her passport instead. But while she had sex on beaches and found love on mountains, what sort of anxiety did she feel about her fertility clock? And was the fleeting love she had for each of these men really the type of love she was looking for?
Kristen, welcome. This is going to be a real fun interview. So, Kristen, thanks for coming on our show.
Thank you for having me.
As I said before, your book was absolutely fabulous, you know. But I want to start with the question. You actually were a sitcom writer, you know, before you started all these travels.
Yes, and still.
What's the connection between what you did as a sitcom writer and did it spark the desire to travel?
I was always from a family who, at least my mother, loved to travel and, you know, took me to Indonesia when I was 15. And I came from Long Beach, California, where there were 39 different languages spoken as a first language. So I was always really interested in cultural differences and excited by kind of getting to be in something that felt authentically different than the life that I grew up in. And so I always traveled, often in the U.S. and I was in my early 20s because I was broke. So it was more about a tent and a car and some peanut butter. But I always traveled. But there was something certainly about my first international trip that really struck me was Chapter 2, Russia, when I went with my best friend and her mom back to Russia where she had been born and had left when she was 3. And that was my first real time kind of immersing in a country with locals, and I couldn't speak, and I had to kind of sit quietly a lot, which was not my forte and not my life at home in a sitcom room where it's just very loud boys yelling at each other all day in a fun way, but that's what it is. And it was such a relief, at first a panic, because I couldn't be funny, I couldn't be smart, I couldn't be fast, I couldn't be myself from home. I had to be this other person who just sat quietly and smiled. But once I embraced it, it was so relaxing. And it started my addiction to that other person I get to be when I travel, who in the book I call Kristen Adjacent. She's sort of like me, but you know, a little softer, less judgmental, a little slower, a little sluttier, all of these things.
You know, it's really interesting because in Hebrew, there's no word for face. It's only faces, because the belief is that we have many faces. We're smart. We're dumb. We're introverted. We're extroverted. We're just about everything. So, and you're right, when you travel, the beauty of traveling is you actually get to choose the identity you take with you.
It's really true. And you don't get to communicate it that well with other people. You know, especially when there's a language difference, there's everybody's kind of interpretation of who you are is up for grabs too, because you can't really clarify, which is kind of fun.
And that's true. And for me, the greatest thing about it is that if you eliminate what everyone has, which is the fear of judgment and rejection, if you take that off the table because you're traveling and everything's temporary, you really are more sexually and verbally and more engaging and so on and so forth.
I want to pick up on the sexual part.
Betsy always wants to pick up on the sexual part, by the way.
First of all, I think it's women's natural birthright to roam and ramble and sample the goods. And you obviously did. And I wanted to know about the advantages of vacation sex. And also, while we're on that topic, who was your best lover of all of these adventures?
She likes to ask short questions. Because, again,
yes, I love that. Yeah.
Do it.
Well, I think the first thing is that I'm not really a one-night stand person in the U.S. Because of a lot of reasons. I don't know. Just kind of wasn't who I was here. Don't judge it. It's just not really my thing here. And in other countries, that wasn't really what I was ever looking for, too. It was more to have, like, a three-day or 1 week or 2 months mad passionate relationship that I didn't allow myself to have in the U.S. because there were so many emotional repercussions and I had so many fears of commitment and I didn't want to settle down and give up my freedom and adventure and all of those things. And so my favorite thing about vacation sex is that you can really, really, really throw yourself into it and not fear, is this the right person? Am I going to want them to call me tomorrow? Is their mom going to annoy me? Do they have a job? Are they going to move in with their friends? All the things that are going on in your head, which I think we can all agree as women is our biggest hurdle to having good sex, is our internal monologue. It quiets it, right? You can just sort of be in the moment and not worry.
I think, by the way, for guys as well, the internal dialogue is the killer of sex.
When you
want to have sex, you want to shut off the frontal lobe and just get into that mammal brain where everything is smell, touch, taste, and kind of really experiential.
Exactly.
When Betsy was saying that it is the woman's inbred right to go roam and taste the goods, I think it's everyone's. Everyone is born like that, and then we're constrained out of the necessity to build something, as opposed to what are those monkeys that are having sex all day long?
Bonobos.
The bonobos. They have sex all day long, but they don't build anything. So it's a combination of the two. So I want to ask.
Remember that Seinfeld episode where George stops having sex and all of a sudden he can learn.
Oh yeah, right, exactly, exactly. He becomes brilliant. He has sex. He's a moron again. So let me ask you this question. Tell me about Paris. You were heartbroken in Paris, and your boyfriend left you. What was it like being heartbroken in Paris, and how did you respond to it?
Well, I think that the Paris trip that you're talking about is the very first one where I had
Your first stop. Your first stop was Paris.
Yeah, I just had a six-year relationship. We broke up. And Paris was my first attempt. I was there with some friends, and I let them go on without me to Amsterdam for a couple of days. And I stayed back in Paris, both because they were driving me crazy, but also because I wanted to try a city by myself, which is my big sort of push of the book, is that how important I feel like solo travel is for women, especially, and for everyone, because it just, you come home so changed and confident and feeling like a super human that you can do anything. But that first time staying in Paris, I was very sad. I was trying very hard to have a great time and enjoy the city by myself. And it was a lot of sexual harassment. It was a lot that I didn't want. It was a lot of chasing after this Australian bartender because he was the only person I knew in the city who I'd met a few days earlier to try to have a romance, and he wasn't interested. I'm getting on trains in wrong directions and just kind of didn't quite gel. But at the end of it, at the end of a couple of days, I felt like I had been alone in Paris for a couple of days. And I felt like that first step of it starting to change me a little bit, just that I had done that and that I knew I could. And it's a hard city to be alone in. And that's another thing, is I feel like when it comes to solo travel, and especially solo single travel, when you're kind of hoping to have some sort of a magical romance or friendships, or just meeting people, instead of sitting quietly and watching the families play. There are cities that are the wrong place for that. And I think Paris is one of them. I think that there's the places where everyone's in love and honeymooning, and it makes you want to kill yourself if you're there alone.
Well, and that's it. We compare ourselves. I wanted to pick up on this word sexual harassment. Isn't sexual harassment simply someone who you're not interested in bothering you? I mean, my whole life I tried to be sexually harassed. I mean, but only by the people I wanted.
Men do not understand our desire for it to stop.
So is there such a thing as sexual harassment, or just being bothered by someone who is making advances and you don't really like them.
Well, that's true. And then when you say no thank you, then they continue to advance. I think that's the key difference.
Ah, there you go.
I think there's something else going on here. I think you are supernaturally attractive because I'm not sure that every woman who went abroad like you to all of these exotic places could pick up such an array of attractive men. And I think that's connected to go back to sitcom. I think comedy is a huge aphrodisiac, a plus to your good looks, et cetera, et cetera. But obviously, you've got charm in spades. I mean, that's very clear.
Gosh, thank you. This is great. I love starting my day with you.
this is it. You know, who needs Prozac? We have Betsy.
No, but I'm serious about that. I mean, you know, Aphrodite was the laughter-loving goddess. And, hey, you know, it is a huge turn-on. And so that combined with your exploratory attitude and your general sexiness, it must have been, you know, very different from the average woman who's traveling by herself to all of these different places.
Maybe that's the case, but I will say that, you know, in other countries where they don't speak English, I can't be funny. And boy, do I try. And I, you know, I was in Argentina for a few months and taking Spanish class. And so I very, very early, because I so badly want to make jokes, was trying to make jokes in Spanish, and it was going terribly. There were all of these Argentines who would be trying to struggle to figure out what I was saying, and then when they would figure it out, because it would be in some way a little edgy or, you know, I'd be trying dirty wordplay or something, they'd be like, oh, don't ever say that again. Don't do that. That's not, no. That's not a thing. Please don't do that.
I don't believe you. I don't believe you. I bet you were hilarious in Argentina.
It's true. It's
so I want to hear this, Kristen. What country or culture did you find yourself personally most sexually connected to? And tell me why Iceland was so strange.
Well, Argentina is the one in my heart. It's the place that I went by myself. Aside from those 2 days in Paris, it was my first solo trip. I got an apartment. I took 5 days a week of Spanish and 3 days a week of tango. And I met all the expats who were in the Spanish classes. I met some expats from all over the world that were living there. I met all the locals. I started my, you know, most important vacation romance, who was Father Juan, who was in my life for 7 years, kind of off and on when we were both single. And I think I just love the country because I love the country. It's this mix of South America and Europe. It's got every kind of, you know, ecological diversity. The people are warm and wonderful. I think I just loved it because of that. But it might be because it was my first place that I went by myself and made friends and made it my own and, you know, felt like it was mine. So that I think is, who knows which reason, but boy, I love it. And then Iceland is so weird. I love it so much. It's so beautiful. They are so strange, though. They're just an odd kind of group of people. They all will say that we're stereotyping when we say that they all believe in otherworldly creatures like gnomes and ghosts and fairies and trolls. But then you go there and everyone's garden has tiny little miniature painted houses for the fairies that live in gardens. You know, where are they going to live otherwise, guys? They need a house. And then you go to their tourist office and you get their, you know, map of the country, and they've got, you know, little drawings on the map to delineate what you can find in these various locations. There's a castle here. There's a whale watching spot there. So there's a castle picture, and there's a little whale picture. And then you see a little ghost picture. And you're like, what's a ghost represent? And then you look at it and you say, oh, it represents a ghost. This is where they say it's haunted. And what's this monster? It looks like a troll. I'm like, oh, this is where the trolls live.
That's what happens when it's 30 below zero most of the year, okay?
And dark.
Yeah, and dark. That's what happens. You just create a lot of things in your head.
No, I think so. I think that you just gotta get through the winter however you can.
Exactly.
I want to ask you another question. How do all of these countries rank with America in terms of fun? I mean, you are obviously a party maven, and it seems to me that, at least according to some books I've read, that we have a problem. We're fun challenged in America. We really don't know how to cut loose and be imaginative and really have a good time. So I wonder how you would rate America on a scale of 1 to 5 compared to other countries.
Well, that's hard because I live in a really fun version of America, right?
Right.
I live in this group of weirdos who I travel with, mm-hmm. who live in America and who make all the weird happen here too. So I have a pretty great time. But I understand that I live in a weird place with weird people. So I imagine that maybe the rest of the country might be less fun. I'm not sure. But I certainly think that we are a bit of an, we're lower on the scale as far as uptightness goes in a lot of ways.
And that's what I meant.
I think it's because we're a little bit more religious than most countries, and therefore,
half of us, right?
I mean, you know, the religion sometimes doesn't have to be an organized one, but the fear of judgment seems to be a little bit greater here. And the more you're afraid of what other people think, then the less fun you have.
Oh, I don't know. I think that's maybe puritanical, but look at Spain and France and look at the festivals they have. My gosh. I mean, it's all...
Oh, yeah. I mean, I remember going out dancing in Madrid, and there was this huge, huge club of incredible music, and people were there till 6 a.m, and it was all ages. It was, it was
fun.
Teenagers through 70-year-olds, like 70-year-old married couples were out dancing at 6 a.m. And I was like, that's so great. You know, in Los Angeles, we've got awful dance places on Sunset Boulevard where everybody's 22 and girls are wearing, you know, Lycra shirts that they're pretending are dresses. And you would never go there after you're 22. The lines are long. The people are ridiculous. It's terrible. You know, it's really hard, I think, to find a good place to just, like, go have a good, fun time when you're not 22 years old here.
But who is this master of revels you mentioned? This Ferris Bueller fellow who arranges parties all over the world?
He's so fantastic. And he's a movie and TV writer here in LA. And he's pretty magic. It was funny. I was talking to a book club this week, been Skyping with book clubs. And there was this woman who said, can I just ask you, is Ferris Bueller Pete Hike? And I was like, yeah, that's his name. She had gone to high school with him and just recognized his personality. Like, he's really that kind of striking that she had just, I don't know this woman. She mm-hmm. just picked him out because she's like, yeah, in Westchester, you know, when we were 17, I was in capes and costumes at Smarties with him that he had organized. You know, he was just kind of always this person.
Uh-huh.
He's pretty magical. He kind of makes everybody have a weird, great time. And he's one of the people who makes my world here pretty fun.
So let me ask you this. In Amsterdam, you took ecstasy, I'm assuming maybe for the first time, and you flirted with another woman. So was it the ecstasy or was it something in you that was just exploring what's it like to flirt with another woman?
Well, I felt like that situation I look back on as an unusual one in my life. Women very rarely hit on me. And I've asked my lesbian friends why this is, and they tell me that I just have a very hetero vibe. I'm like, this is just very strange. It never happens. So I think that maybe the reason that it happened was that, you know, I was beaming love in all directions due to drugs. But I don't know. Who knows if that was a little something. I didn't do anything. You know, I didn't get together with her, mostly because she was a little bit filthy in just sort of she seems actually filthy way, like dirty, like her skin seemed dirty. And she had crutches and couldn't remember how she'd gotten them and just seemed like a little bit too much of a mess. And so that happened, but I don't know. You know, I still have never kissed a girl. I don't know why. I think about it. It's something interesting to think about, but it's never happened.
Your view of marriage changes through the book. I wonder if you want to talk about that, because in the beginning you said it's a doomed proposition. You know, growing will end it, and everybody gets divorced, and why do it? And then in the end, you wind up with this great guy and some adventure mixed in.
Yeah, well, you know, I got married last month. So I have all kinds of feelings about marriage right now.
Yeah, I'm asking you, first of all, mazel tov. Second of all, do you think that you're going to stay monogamous?
Yes, for sure. Except for that one time in Russia, I'm not a cheater. I very much believe that if things are broken, you break up and then you go find somebody else. If you have an open marriage, you have an open marriage. And if you can make that work, God bless. But this whole, like, I'm unhappy, and so I'm going to go find somebody else so that I'm never, ever alone for a minute and cheat on this person, and then so I can seamlessly go from one person to another. I don't think that's such a great thing to do to somebody. So yes, monogamous. I'm all in now. As far as the way that I feel about marriage, I really, really, really feel like there was a big difference that happened that I didn't expect when we got married that made that made us feel closer. I had moved in with my now husband and his two kids last August, and we were, you know, living together. I was going with his ex-wife to the kids' back-to-school nights. You know, I'm in here. You know, where else am I going to go? Neither of us can afford the house without the other person. I sort of felt like, how can marriage do anything? You know, I'm deep in. But there really was this feeling, especially with the kids, and that was one of the main reasons that we did it, was that they felt that we were all closer and that I was for sure going to stick around. I think marriage to kids means a lot. But it also made me feel more like we belonged to each other, more. I feel more protective of him than I did before in some ways. I wasn't ready before, and I still, God, it's a very scary proposition. And
How is marriage sex different from travel sex?
You know, it is very, very lovely and sweet.
It's supposed to be a lot better. You know, two studies came out in 2013 that women have less good sex in hookups than they do in long-term committed relationships.
That's interesting.
I know. So,
are you guys married?
Yes, I've been married for 42 years.
I'm married. My first marriage was 26 years, and my wife died of breast cancer. And I'm married again now for 14 years.
Wow, good for you guys. Yeah, I mean, I feel like it's so much work, right? Do you have any advice? I'm a newly married person. What's
yes,
your advice?
Yes, my first advice is to take the word work out of there. It is not work. It's an ongoing adventure, exactly like your travels. And the whole idea is to defeat stasis and ennui. It really is. And you all both seem to have this adventurous spirit. And as long as you keep that going, and you keep growing, I disagree with in the beginning when you say growing is going to end your marriage. Hey, it's going to make it fantastic. It's going to make it richer, more fun. I think it's really important to keep the courtship going, to make it a continual courtship every single day, because you never know what will happen the next day.
I completely agree with her, and I'm going to add two other things. And the first is, you know what? Nothing is that important to fight over. You know, have a lot of laughs. Be comfortable with agreeing to disagree. You know, if there's a conflict, put it away quickly and just really have a lot of adventure in your life. And share a lot of differences and be comfortable with those differences. And remember to always treat your partner better than you treat anyone else, period.
Isn't that easy? Isn't that the hardest thing to do? It's not hard. It's not natural. I always say that sometimes you treat strangers the best.
Yes.
You treat your spouse a little bit worse, and you treat yourself the worst.
Right. And it should be the exact opposite.
No.
Okay.
No.
You should love yourself, because if you love yourself, then you're going to have all this energy to love your significant others, and then you should treat everyone, you know, with respect. But you're right. People do it the other way around, and that's why people aren't happy.
It's true. It's true.
But I'm a great believer in passion and disagree. I think you should have some fights every now and then. I don't think that not fighting is good. It's just an expression of, well, if you look at the old 1930s movies, think of all the flying plates and so on. I mean, that was exuberant. It was sexy.
Depending on the price of the plate, Betsy.
True, true, true. You don't want your lowest stuff hurled across the room. But seriously, I think passion is hugely important, keeping that alive, however you do it individually.
Yep, I'm going to do it. I'm going to do it, guys. I can do it.
I think your husband is lucky. And you know what? Don't stop having adventure.
Well, okay? I agree. And that is something that we're great at. We've done a ton of travel. We do a lot of little adventures in our own city. He's really my match for that.
And I can imagine the conversation at dinner. I can just imagine. You all must be divine together.
So I'm going to bring something up that's not so pleasant. Your stepmother.
Yes. Okay.
How did she affect you, your travels, and your sexuality?
Well, how did she affect those things? I'm not sure that she affected those things. I think that she, her big effect was my view on marriage. You know, my father very much was afraid of being alone. And when my parents split up when I was, you know, 13, 14 in there, he sort of immediately met this woman that he was, you know, telling me right away was not the right woman. But he also would say, you know, I don't want to sit alone. And he ended up marrying her and having three kids with her. And he knew from the beginning, but it was all of this fear-based decision-making that led him to this woman that was that brought about incredible children. I love my siblings dearly, and I'm so grateful that she was the one that he picked because they came out of her. But really, their marriage was a real mess, and she destroyed my relationship with my father. And so looking at what could happen when you made a decision out of fear, and then as I started to watch some of my friends around me getting older and starting to make decisions out of fear and just marry people who are just okay or get pregnant too soon or all the things that women do as they get older and start to panic, I just really, really rejected that. I really, really did not want that in my life. And I just hadn't grown up seeing marriages that worked. My parents were very in love and dancing in the kitchen and having good laughs for 16 years. And then that failed. And then my dad, you know, chose kind of an awful woman who he shouldn't have been with because he was afraid of being alone. And that was around until she died. And just hadn't seen a lot of really.
But you
great,
said at the end of the book that you learned the greatest
really
lesson of your life at
it.
Your stepmother's, your stepmother's funeral. You want to expand on that?
Or is it that all evil people die?
No. So I met my husband's kids the same month that my stepmother died of breast cancer. And, you know, as I was looking at becoming a stepmother myself, I lost my stepmother who really, you know, left her breast cancer untreated, didn't tell anybody about it. Maybe she wouldn't have died if she hadn't done that. She worked at a hospital 5 days a week and still didn't have anyone look at the lump. I was furious at her for leaving her kids and the situation and, you know, not taking care of things. So I was mad again at her in ways that I hadn't been since I was a kid. And at the funeral, I felt very much, you know, horrified for my little siblings who had lost their mother, but like I wasn't mourning myself, you know, that I wasn't going to miss her. It was just for them that I was mourning her. But then, you know, I spent the week, you know, kind of in bed with all of them and saw them at the funeral speaking about their mother. And they were so proud and so lovely. And, you know, that same month I met my husband's kids who were 9 and 11-year-old boys. All they wanted was to impress me. You know, they wanted to do something that they were good at when we met. So we went to the beach so that one could surf and the other could show off on the rings, you know. And they were funny and nice to me, and they've never been anything but that. And it made me, you know, wonder, I wasn't like that with her, you know, and part of it was because my dad was constantly telling me she wasn't going to stick around because she wasn't good enough, and so I just ignored her. But still, had I been that nice to her, would she have come after me in the way that she did and ostracized me and cut me out of my dad's life the way that she did? Maybe not, you know, and so kind of taking my own place in that responsibility circle, as I watched how kind these little kids in this house were being to me, was a big deal and kind of coming to peace with that.
Kristen, I'm so impressed with your objectivity. I really am. I mean, I'm doing life coaching, you know, for 37 years. And for someone who is able to actually question the other side of the coin and ask themselves what kind of responsibility they have in another person's reaction is rare. So not only are you beautiful and you're funny, you're also, you know, quite profound in your introspection.
Well, so thank you, Dr. Gluck.
You're welcome.
See, I didn't need Prozac or therapy this morning.
You needed me, girl.
Now, speaking of therapy, you went through it and antidepressants and all that, but you said the big moment was when you wrote a sitcom about your family.
Yes. Yeah.
I love that part. It was very cathartic. And apparently you included your stepmother in this, or was it just your mother and father and their breakup? I'd love to hear more about that.
I wrote her out. I catered to my fantasy that she didn't exist.
Oh, I love it. Okay. What happened to this?
Actually, I thought this would be a great exercise even for non-writing patients of yours who are trying to come to peace with their family. Because, you know, I talk about in the book that that what you need to do when you're writing characters for anything, but for sitcoms especially, is that you need the thing about them that is their flaw that makes them funny, right? And then the thing about them that's the special thing they bring to the party that nobody else brings that makes you love them. And as I wrote my family and myself, it was amazing to me how easy it was for me to come up with also the special thing about them that made them so lovable. And as I looked at them as characters, it helped with that objectivity you were just talking about, and at myself too. And we all got changed for, you know, the TV versions of ourselves, and not all of it was autobiographical. But it helped me when I was around my mother and she would say something very typically Linda, you know, that might drive me insane. I could almost watch her like I would watch Archie Bunker when he would say something racist. And you would think to yourself, well, that was racist, but you kind of laugh and still love him. And it was okay because he was Archie. That's just who he is. That's his flaw, right? And it helped me step back from my family a lot. You know, I still don't do it all the time.
That's actually great. So I want to get into this question that, you know, you get all kinds of cases, and very often I will have men come in who are very successful in their life, in their business, but they are obsessed with their penis size. Mm. So you, as an experienced lover traveling the world, how important is penis size, and does that have anything to do with why you're not so turned on to Asian men?
Oh, well, I don't, you know, who knows? If I had gotten that far with any Asian men, perhaps that could be the reason, but I don't even get that far. For me, I just think that there's been a couple of Asian men I've been very attracted to, and it's because they're tall. They're usually a little too small, a little too hairless. You know, it's like the same thing that makes Asian women so beautiful, which is their small, delicate hairlessness, for me, is a turnoff in men. Not fair, not nice. It happened. Came out in an Ambien fueled email in the book. But anyway, you know, I am not as much of a size queen as many others are. My best friend, that's all she cares about, but it's because she's got all kinds of hang ups about other things that happen in bed that she doesn't want to ever happen. So she needs a big penis. That's all she needs. That's everything to her. You know,
She probably had triplets.
So yeah. I'm not as judgmental. I'm sorry?
She probably had triplets.
Oh, no, she's had two elective C-sections because she's so afraid of messing things up down there. Since that's the one dynamic that she really enjoys.
Don't tell me that.
Yes.
Okay. So this is important because, you know, the great number of people are hearing this are going to be healed by the fact that penis size is not the most important thing in great lovemaking. Would you agree?
Absolutely not. Not for me. Some women, maybe yes. But for me, no.
But a turn-on is, for you, a certain amount of curiosity involved and mystery, I would say, even.
For sure, and chemistry, right? Like, there's something about, you know, I focus a lot on skin. There's something about, like, ooh, I want to smell his skin. I want to eat his skin. I want to touch the skin. Like, I think that what that is, it's just, there's the way that in Spanish, maybe I don't know if it's in all Spanish speaking countries, but in Argentina, the phrase for having chemistry is tenemos piel, which means we have a skin, like we share a skin almost. Like there's like a skin that goes around the two of us. And so I love that because skin for me is always this thing of just like, it's about their skin. I don't care about the penis as much.
I love it. Okay, you know, now we're going to get 100 calls on skin fetishes. This is great.
But I think all of this is remarkable because yesterday I saw on the internet there's a huge news study about young women who are anorgasmic, who are so clutched by media propaganda and by performance anxiety that they're not enjoying themselves sexually at all.
And Bessie, I find that to be very true, by the way. I get people all the time. I've never in my entire life have seen more women attractive, smart, intelligent who are aorgasmic.
Well, this is really? this is a new thing I read about yesterday. And what strikes me about your book is that you belong to the old school, you know? I mean, you are really uninhibited, in touch with your sexuality, and don't seem to have any of the guilt trips or performance anxieties of so many women of maybe an earlier generation, maybe not your generation.
Yeah, I don't know. It's very interesting, right? It's a very divisive book. I'm getting, I would say, you know, by a long shot, the feedback I've been getting from the strangers who find me on Twitter or whatever is, you know, by and large, much more, you know, maybe 90% positive. The Amazon reviews, 95% positive. It's mostly positive. But there is this section of people who feel completely the opposite about me and about the book and about my life choices. There's even been a couple of friends said, you know, have you rewritten the book a lot since I read it? So they read an early version. And I said, no. And they're like, there's all these people who are calling it raunchy and you slutty. And I just don't remember there being that much crazy sex in it. You know, like in a certain group of people, it feels like a totally normal life and number of partners for a human who was single until she was 40. But for, you know, the world who married their high school sweetheart or their college sweetheart or something, or, you know, or who, you know, there's some of those people who aren't judgmental still about it all. But a lot of them are just like, God, this is so crazy. And it's just, it's a divided country, right?
Kristen, the more people who are against your book, the more books you're going to sell.
That's true.
Okay. Yeah, but I think we're getting deep into the territory of double standards. I mean, this whole issue of slut shaming, that's absolutely retro. This whole thing's absurd because all of the new research points out that the female libido is not even relational and that women are biologically super sexed. And in the new Darwinian narrative, of course, they were just, you know, highly sexed, carousing ladies who had concurrent partners and cavorted with everybody. So all of this seems like an effort to push back the clock to me. And
yeah, well, I think it's all of the right-wing stuff that goes on in this country, I feel like, is so much like push it back, push it back, push it back. There's a lot of weird movements to do that in a lot of departments.
Yes, but you were very proactive in your sex life. It's not as if you were, you know, a sex doll or anything like that. These were your choices. And that's entirely different, it seems to me, from being a doormat or the town slut. So,
oh, sure.
So in that regard, I mean, this is a very feminist statement that you're making. You know, you took your sexuality in your own hands and you ran with it.
You owned it. You owned it.
You owned it and ran with it.
I think so. You know, it's funny that you'll hear this criticism that, like, it, you know, I thought she was going to go off and be this big, strong woman, and instead she chased boys. And it's funny to think there's the perspective of that, like, you know, going out and owning your sexuality and having a great time is you not feeling like you're enough as a woman, and so you have to go find men. And I'm like, how is just having fun feeling like I'm not enough? You know, there was somebody who wrote me, like, You know, you had that moment on top of the mountain on page 100 or something where you were alone and realized you were happier than you had been in bed with your Spanish teacher, and yet you kept chasing boys. And I'm like, well, just because I had a nice afternoon alone doesn't mean I want to spend my whole life alone. That's not
Kristen, it's just sour grapes. It's the bald guy talking about how, you know, hair is not that important. It's just sour grapes. What you simply did is you created experiences. And when people are afraid, you know what they do? Nothing. They don't change. And when people are not afraid, you know what they do? They explore. So their insecurity are projecting out of you. You did all these things out of shallowness, out of insecurity, out of reaction. But in fact, you did it out of proaction. Okay?
Yeah,
and you wanted to have fun, and good for you.
Thank you.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. I mean, I think that this is the path. And the interesting thing is, in the English department, we would call this a female buildings roman. That is, it's a story of growth, you know, and you begin with one view and you end up with an entirely different one. So travel has many meanings for you, but one of them is as you call it, you say rebooting your brain. It was rebooting your soul as well. So that in the end, it was an incredibly maturing experience. There's a long tradition, you know, about travel literature, doing that for people.
Yeah.
And you fall right into that, but you make it so amusing and so much fun to read. You're an amazing travel companion. Let's put it that way.
Aw, thank you. That is so sweet. Yeah, my favorite thing that has been happening, which is the whole reason I wanted to write it really, has been women reaching out and saying, I just bought my first solo plane ticket because of your book, or I'm going to drive across the country by myself for the first time because of your book. And it's so exciting to watch people it's okay.
It is. You really have done that. And one thing I want to say is that, you know, for those who would appear to be judgmental, you really will stay monogamous in this relationship and you will make it work. Why all those who were afraid to actually explore their life and explore their sexuality end up marrying out of fear and never become monogamous. So, again, good for you.
Thank you. Yeah, I really think you have to be in the right place or it just can't work out.
Sweetheart, we could go on forever because you were amazing, but we have to end. And I just want to say to you, your travels, your trips, your insight, your humor has really, you know, become the Kerouac, who I read God knows how many years ago. You really do inspire and you're just terrific.
God bless. Thank you so much.
It's so incredibly
nice
funny, which is so sexy. Thank you very, very much. Your husband is a very lucky guy.
Yeah, tell him to be good or I'll go get him.
Okay, I will.
Bye, sweetheart.
Thanks.
Thanks, guys.
I want to once again really thank Krista Newman for coming onto our show. It was wonderful. I want you to pick up a copy of her book. Pick up a copy of her book, What I Was Doing While You Were Breeding. It's on Amazon.com and visit her website on theotherkristennewman.com. So, Betts, I loved her. I really thought that she was open and genuine and a true explorer, and I don't think she was running away. I think that she was actually trying to actually see what buttons in life we're going to really turn her on.
I agree. I think she's a bold and charming person. And what I love is that she took her mother's advice. Would you rather have an adventure by yourself or would you rather have one scary moment? And so she chose to jump right in with both feet and have all of these amazing adventures abroad, which most people fantasize but are afraid to do.
Exactly. Meaning it's funny that people love watching movies with all these great adventures, but they always do it from the safety of their bedroom. And you know what? It's one thing being a spectator in the stands and another person being on the ball field. This girl was on the ball field.
Right. And you know what? The people who fantasize and don't do anything about it are miserable in old age.
I get this theory. We're all going to die. You might as well try to explore and see what's real for you. And she does it in such a non-judgmental way. She's not saying everyone who explores is right or those who don't are wrong. She actually just owns her own actions, and I love her for that.
And she's so incredibly funny about it.
Yeah, she's great.
Which is a sign of IQ and perspective and everything else.
Oh, she gets an A on our book.
A plus.
I am Dr. Errol Gluck. Betsy and I both want you to remember, to every problem there is a solution. Please check out our other episodes. There is really something for everyone. You're going to be addicted to it. GluckRadio.com. And while you're out there, you're going to buy Betsy Prelow's books on the art of seduction on Amazon.com. They're entitled Seductress and Swoon, which are out in paperback now, and you know what that means. Keep listening and keep sending us your feedback. Till next time.